Our Country, the Marvel of Nations, Chapter 16, Epilogue. Inventions of the 19th Century. The changes that have taken place in the brief 100 years last past, and the revolutions which have changed the whole aspect of the methods of life and living, are very graphically stated in the introduction of a volume called The Progress of Invention in the 19th Century. From these pages, we transcribe a few words. To appreciate them, the wonders of this age, let us briefly contrast the conditions of today with those of 100 years ago. This is no easy task, for the comparison not only involves the experiences of two generations, but it is like the juxtaposition of a star with the noonday sun, whose superior brilliancy obliterates the lesser light.
But reverse the wheels of progress, and let us make a quick run of 100 years into the past. And what are our experiences? Before we get to our destination, we find the wheels themselves beginning to thump and jolt, and the passage becomes more difficult, more uncomfortable, and much slower. We are no longer gliding along in a luxurious palace car behind a magnificent locomotive, traveling on steel rails at 60 miles an hour. But we find ourselves nearing the beginning of the 19th century in a rickety, rumbling, dusty stagecoach. Pause and consider the change for a moment in some of its broader aspects. First, let us examine the present more closely. For the average busy man, never looking behind him for comparisons, does not fully appreciate or estimate at its real value the age in which he lives. There are today, statistics of 1889, 445,064 miles of railway tracks in the world. This would build 17 different railway tracks of two rails each around the entire world, or would girdle Mother Earth with 34 belts of steel. If extended in straight lines, it would build a track of two rails to the moon and more than 100,000 miles beyond it. The United States has nearly half of the entire mileage of the world and gets along with 36,746 locomotives, nearly as many passenger coaches, and more than 1.25 million freight cars, which latter, if coupled together, would make nearly 3 continuous trains reaching across the American continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. The movement of passenger trains is equivalent to dispatching 37 trains per day around the world, and the freight train movement is in like manner equal to dispatching 53 trains a day around the world. Add to this the railway business controlled by other countries, and one gets some idea of how far the stagecoach has been left behind. Today, we eat supper in one city and breakfast in another, so many hundreds of miles east or west that we are compelled to set our watches to the new meridian of longitude in order to keep our engagement.
But railroads and steam cars constitute only one of the stirring elements of modern civilization. As we make the backward run of 100 years, we have passed by many milestones of progress. Let us see if we can count some of them as they disappear behind us. We quickly lose the telephone, phonograph, and graphophone. We no longer see the cable cars or electric railways. The electric lights have gone out. The telegraph disappears. The sewing machine, reaper, and thrasher have passed away. And so also have all India rubber goods. We no longer see any photographs, photo engravings, photolithographs, or snapshot cameras. The wonderful octuple web perfecting printing press, printing, pasting, cutting, folding, and counting newspapers at the rate of 96,000 per hour, or 1,600 per minute, shrinks at the beginning of the century into an insignificant prototype. We lose all planing and woodworking machinery, and with it, the endless variety of sashes, doors, blinds, and furniture in unlimited variety. There are no gas engines, no passenger elevators, no asphalt pavement, no steam fire engine, no triple expansion steam engine, no Gifford injector, no celluloid articles, no barbed wire fences, no time locks for safes, no self-binding harvesters, no oil or gas wells, no ice machines, nor cold storage.
We lose air engines, stem-winding watches, cash registers and cash carriers, the great suspension bridges and tunnels, the Suez Canal, iron frame buildings, monitors and heavy ironclads, revolvers, torpedoes, magazine guns and Gatling guns, linotype machines, all practical typewriters, all pasteurizing, knowledge of microbes or disease germs, and sanitary plumbing, water gas, soda water fountains, air brakes, coal tar dyes and medicines, nitroglycerin, dynamite and gun cotton, dynamo electric machines, aluminum ware, electric locomotives, Bessemer steel with its wonderful developments, ocean cables, enameled ironware, Welsbach gas burners, electric storage batteries, the cigarette machine, hydraulic dredges, the roller mills, Midling's purifiers, and patent process flour, tin can machines, car couplings, compressed air drills, sleeping cars, the dynamite gun, the McKay shoe machine, the circular knitting machine, the Jacquard loom, wood pulp for paper, fire alarms, the use of anesthetics in surgery, oleomargarine, street sweepers, artesian wells, friction matches, steam hammers, electroplating, nail machines, false teeth, artificial limbs and eyes, the spectroscope, the kinetoscope or moving pictures, acetylene gas, X-ray apparatus, horseless carriages, and, but, enough, the reader exclaims, and indeed it is not pleasant to contemplate the loss. The negative conditions of that period extend into such an appalling void that we stop short, shrinking from the thought of what it would mean to modern civilization to eliminate from its life these potent factors of its existence. In addition to all this, among the more remarkable of still more recent devices and inventions, may be mentioned the coin weighing and counting machine, just installed in the money institutions of Chicago, and which wrought consternation among the bank employees through the prospect of the loss of their employment. Under the direction of one of the inventors, 3,600 gold coins were accurately weighed and counted in an incredibly short space of time. A small dynamo furnishes motive power, and the whole instrument is contained in a case 2 feet square and 1 foot high. We have also to make the startling announcement that, according to an editorial in the August Patent Record, the triumph of the long-sought airship is practically accomplished. And it is a son of the New World, Monsieur Santos Dumont, a talented native of Brazil, who has scored the first victory. This man guided his flying machine at will, in the face of opposing winds, 3 times around the Eiffel Tower in Paris, where the experiment was made, and back again to the place of starting. Experts who watched the experiments predict that aerial navigation will be by airships propelled by self-generated power, and that the first installment of the enterprise has already been witnessed. It surpasses Count Zeppelin's device. Speaking of submarine boats, those wonderful contrivances which propel themselves underwater and explore at will the bottom of the sea, recovering therefrom the buried treasures and revealing wonders of the deep, or in the dark and secret depths attaching torpedoes to the huge ironclads of an enemy for their destruction. Speaking of this great advanced step in man's inroad upon the ocean, the Popular Science Monthly says, "We should take genuine pride in the fact that citizens of our own country are today foremost in the construction of these mighty engines." Wireless telegraphy, communicating between distant places without the intervention of wires, seems likely to receive its greatest development in American hands. Its practicability was recently demonstrated by a very successful and interesting test made July 27, 1901, in New York Harbor, between the steamer Kaiser Wilhelm der Grosse and the Cunard liner Lucania. The Lucania sailed for Liverpool at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, while the Kaiser Wilhelm der Grosse remained berthed at Pier 51, North River. For more than an hour, the two vessels were in constant communication with each other, and until the Lucania passed out of the Narrows, there was no difficulty in reading her signals. On another occasion, communications were kept up on the Lucania for 20 miles from land from Holyhead, Wales. Vessels coming to New York may be communicated with in this weird manner 12 hours before they are sighted off Sandy Hook. The Great Gun. the United States has already fired a shot, which, from its moral effect, has been heard around the world. But it is now about to fire a shot which, in a more nearly literal sense, may be heard around the world. The great 16-inch, 126-ton gun now being built for the government at the Watervliet, New York arsenal is 49¼ feet long, more than 6 feet in diameter at the breech, and will have an extreme range of over 20 miles. Its projectile will weigh 2,370 pounds, and a single discharge will cost $865. If fired at its maximum elevation from the battery at the south end of New York, in a northerly direction, its projectile would pass over the city of New York, over Grant's Tomb, Spuyten Duyvil, Riverdale, Mount St. Vincent, Ludlow, Yonkers, and would land near Hastings on the Hudson, nearly 20 miles away. The extreme height of its trajectory would be 30,516 feet, or nearly 6 miles. This means that if the gun was located at the foot of Mount Everest, the highest of the Himalayas, the missile, as shown in the accompanying diagram, would fly entirely over the mountain, and its trajectory, as shown by the curved line, would lead it so far above the top of the mountain that though the Great Pyramid of Gizeh were placed on the top of the mountain and the Washington Monument reared on top of,
that the hissing, roaring shell would queer them all and still have room to spare. Such an exhibition of the power of man's devices over huge masses of matter is calculated to make our War Department feel that they are in possession of an engine that nothing can resist. The weapon, when completed, will be sent to the Pan American Exposition at Buffalo and tested by throwing a shot 21 miles out into Lake Erie. If the tests are satisfactory, the government will order 40 of the guns. Then the United States will hold, by all odds, the most terrible engines of war possessed by any nation on Earth. Of the whole number of guns, 18 will be placed in New York Harbor, 10 at San Francisco, 8 in Boston, and 4 at Hampton Roads. So says a dispatch from Washington. This is really but another object lesson showing the great progress America has made in the iron and steel industries, to which some writers attribute our victories in the Spanish War. The Frankfurter Zeitung expresses itself thus. Statistics prove that the United States has greater wealth, greater resources, greater energy than any other nation. And there is good reason for this. No doubt there are some objectionable phases in American public life, but there is much more light than shadow. Freedom and toleration reign in the United States. Coercion is unknown. There is no nobility, and no one claims advantages because he is his father's son. There is no narrow, reactionary monarchism. Red tape is unknown, and the citizens are never made the slaves of state machines. If Spain had won in the late war, a people full of national arrogance, a nation subject to the dictates of incapable politicians, would have been strengthened. This has been averted by the American victory. The Vorwärts, the organ of the socialists in the Argentine Confederation, is not quite so sure that we are superior to other nations, but it predicts the ascendancy of American industry and United States hegemony over South America. It says, in the main,
the Spanish ships were supposed to be equal to anything afloat. The Spanish ships were riddled with shot and shell, but the American vessels escaped unharmed. That the American crews were so very much superior to the Spanish sailors is not to be supposed. The only explanation is that the American iron industry is much more advanced. This must necessarily shake the foundations of the iron trade. And if the South American republics do not willingly transfer their custom to the United States, the big republic, respecting nothing but brute force, will compel South Americans by main force to become her customers. Translation for the Literary Digest. Thus, the South American countries and all Europe are beginning to tremble with anxiety over the fast-growing prosperity of the United States, fearing what they may suffer through our competition. Floating straws show clearly which way the current tends. Thus, we learn from the public prints that during 1900, 12 nations spent over $10 million each for American farm products. Stranger still does it appear that the United States should be called upon to furnish coal to Europe. But the report is now current that over 5 million tons of coal have been ordered from the United States to Europe this present year, and that 4 freight steamers are now under construction in Newport News, Virginia, to convey the product. An article in the September 1901 number of the Cosmopolitan by the editor J. Brisbane Walker enumerates 9 great inventions which have come to the front since the Columbian Exposition of 1893 as follows. 1. The submarine boat. 2. Wireless telegraphy. 3. Telephoning under the sea. 4. The X-rays. 5. The high-pressure 20-mile gun. 6. The small-bore rifle. 7. The baby incubator. 8. The automobile. 9. Acetylene gas. Of these, he says, in the order of military importance, may be named first the submarine boat. A brief reference to the history of this class of vessels follows, with a notice of the more recent developments, which we quote.
Meantime, France, in which no great armor, shipbuilding, or gun factory interests exercise influence over the government, has considered the question on its merits and has brought its best scientific minds to bear on submarine construction. The results are as might easily have been guessed. In fact, the practical demonstration goes far beyond the prophecies of even the most sanguine. They are best told by quoting the following cablegram to the New York World of July 20th. Battleships to go, submarines rule. Remarkable feat of the Gustave Zaid upsets calculations for the French Navy. Sails from Toulon, eludes fleet at Ajaccio, torpedoes battleship, and escapes without being seen. Paris, July 20th. After seeing the submarine boat Gustave Zaid sail 175 miles from Toulon to the harbor of Ajaccio, Corsica, elude the vigilance of the French fleet, torpedo the great battleship Charles Martel, and cross the Mediterranean to Marseille, 225 miles, all this time unobserved, the French Minister of Marine, Monsieur de Lansan, has decided to delay the building of several monster warships already voted by the National Congress. All the naval experts here are profoundly impressed by the recent progress in submarine vessels and navigating. They declare that the huge ships are doomed. Monsieur de Lansan intends to present to the Senate and Chamber, as soon as the Congress meets, a bill to modify the naval expenditures, providing for constructing, in place of large warships contemplated, 40 submarine craft of the Gustave Zaid type, 159 feet long, but larger, and 80 purely defensive submarine boats of the Goubet type. Number 1 is 16 and 1/2 feet long, number 2 is 26 and 1/4 feet, which cannot operate beyond 15 miles, but are so transportable that 8 can be loaded aboard an ordinary cruiser. This is the point to be kept clearly in mind, that the $5 million expended in a single battleship would mean 100 submarine boats, a flotilla powerful enough to destroy our entire Navy as it today exists.
The phenomena of wireless telegraphy, telephoning under the sea, and the X-ray are all in the line of what might have been reasonably expected from the progress made in electrical development up to 1893. The high-pressure 20-mile gun, which puts the greatest cities under tribute from vessels that are practically below the horizon, is also in the line of that evolution of the gun which Jules Verne predicted more than a quarter of a century ago. The small-bore rifle, firing its shot with high initial velocity, is in the nature of an unexpected development. For many years, the evolution of the army rifle seemed to be in the direction of large bore and heavy metal. The efficiency of the small caliber had been suspected by a few military scientific minds prior to the Boer War. But it remained for the South African Republicans, sparsely gathered behind rocks or concealed in sandpits on the hillsides, to demonstrate the marvelous efficiency of this new art.
so scattered as to leave no target for artillery and very little for even rifle fire, these boers, in their sandpits, long practiced in marksmanship, were able to pick off the English troops at such great distances as to render their artillery almost ineffective, and to lead to almost certain death the venturesome brigade which sought to charge over the exposed territory. The question also comes up in connection with the small bore rifle as to whether the most powerful military nation of the future will not be one which has put into the hands of every citizen a gun with ammunition enough so that he may learn to shoot fairly straight. It is very curious how invention is bringing about a leveling of classes. If, indeed, the citizen with a rifle and a half dozen strings of ammunition, leaving his workshop without previous military instruction, as did the boer, can become the most virile of soldiers, then the Republic of the future will be safe from violence, because military superiority will rest with the citizen. The baby incubator is one of the marvels of science. The same paper gives a forecast of the more important improvements and changes of the near future, among which we notice the following. 1. Aeroplanes. 2. The universal introduction of automobiles. 3. Scientific methods of thought transference. 4. Substitution of economic methods of heating cities by oil and gas, etc., etc. The discoveries and improvements enumerated above, with others which might be mentioned, such as additional advances in photographic electricity, the Röntgen or X-rays, Crookes's tubes, the teleautograph, telephotograph, the microphone, a device to make audible the minutest sound, the megaphone, to make a whisper roar like Niagara, etc., crowd upon us so fast as to throw our dictionaries out of date and bewilder us by the whirl of events. It opens to us an age unique in its multitudinous powers, just the theater on which the spiritual agencies of evil, predicted in the last days to walk unseen the earth abroad, might be expected to exhibit their preternatural wonders. Closing reflections. Before leaving this subject, a few contemplative remarks in reference to the whole question may not be out of place. The subject is of such magnitude, and the issues involved are of such momentous importance that nothing pertaining to them can be considered redundant until the whole situation is repeatedly impressed upon the mind, and everyone has a clear and vivid idea of the crisis into which we are about to plunge. It is a world question to which in this work we have invited, and again re-invite, attention. It belongs to the same category which includes the creation of the world itself, the world's redemptive progress and history, and now the last change which is to befall this planet, the chief orb with which we are acquainted, an orb made conspicuous by having received one visit from the Son of God, bearing upon his divine bosom the load of our sin and shame, the orb on which the cross that shocked and thrilled the whole universe, angels, principalities, and powers, has been upreared. An orb soon to be made more conspicuous still by a second visit from the Son of Man, robed with the power and grandeur of the Lord of all, in the glory of his Father and of the holy angels. The line that we are soon to pass is the line of eternity, behind which will forever drift away the trials and conflicts of a sinful probation, and beyond which will open the glorious vistas of everlasting day to those who have made room and made themselves ready for the King in his beauty. The object of these pages has been to quicken a desire in every heart to be able to finish his course with joy, and the design of the facts and arguments presented has been to aid in this work of self-examination and spiritual progress. It is sometimes said that such subjects as these belong to the dry formulas of theory and lack practical value. A greater mistake could not be made. Nothing will stir one up more deeply to make a practical preparation for the coming of the Son of Man than a convincing array of evidences that that coming is right at hand. For, as the Apostle John says, we know that, when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And every man that hath this hope in him, in Christ, purifieth himself, even as he, Christ, is pure. 1 John 3, verse 2-3. That is the ultimate object in every case, to lead men to become pure as Christ is pure. And all who do this will be ready to hail him with joy when he appears and share in the salvation he comes to bring. Hebrews 9, verse 28. When we consider that there is one who ruleth in the kingdoms of men, and when we look at his past course in dealing with nations, according to his own statements and the plain declarations of history, the query arises, why should he not speak of the United States of America, this last unique development of human power, as the human race has now completed its circuit around the earth? When the thrilling point is reached, as it is now reached, when this gospel of the kingdom can be preached in all the world, as a sign that the end is the next event in order, Matthew 24, verse 14, and there are no further nationalities to be developed for it to go to, should we not recognize that as the time when the great author of prophecy would have something to say concerning the last nation to appear? Without this, his course would seem to lack uniformity, and his work be incomplete. But no such reflections can be laid to his charge. With this, a broad basis is laid on which to build. In these premises, as a postulate, all phases of the argument center, and from them all conclusions flow. They will bear stating again and again.
A prophecy is uttered, setting forth its great truths by symbols, for one of which, looking the wide earth over, we find no possible location except our own land. This symbol is independent and unique. It cannot possibly represent a government set forth by any other symbol. If the symbol referred to does not apply to our own country, then it follows that, symbolically, the prophecy is at fault, describing a country or government with no symbol to apply to it, and having a symbol with no object to answer to it. This would be, again, a reflection on the prophecies, which no friend of the Bible could for a moment tolerate. And no application which necessitates this can for a single instant be accepted. But not only is the prophecy hedged about with these limitations, but the time when the power symbolized should make its appearance is definitely stated. The United States arose at precisely that point of time. The nature of the government, too, first gentle and lamb-like, the defender of equal rights, both civil and religious, is noted in the prophecy. And this also we find in America, but we find it nowhere else. It is not found in any other nation that now exists, or has existed under the whole wide heaven, so far as history has at any time stated. These considerations bind the application of the prophecy about with bands of iron. Not a pin or rivet can be moved. Let this point be fixed securely in the mind. The Lord God of the prophets has spoken about America. He has spoken especially for the good of this land, where the closing rays of the gospel beam forth in all their intensity, as well as for the good of all lands, that he may show an object lesson to the world of the fulfillment of his word. It may be said, perhaps, that there are other nations of more account in the world than America. Nations having longer chronological records, a larger number of inhabitants, greater historical volume, more enduring and long-continued customs and methods, a more settled and molding influence on larger masses of people. This, in these respects, may all be so. But this does not alter the fact that here is a nation of an unequaled profession, set forth for a special purpose in a certain place at a particular time, to stand in the very focus of the stirring events of the closing hours of time. Raised up and developed by the special providence and manifest design of God to accomplish its special work in connection with His truth and the proclamation of His gospel, as the world closes its long career of sin, and the plan of redemption planted on the ruins of the fall, growing in clearness and strength for 6,000 years, shall open into the living blossom of eternity. These points all stand as pillars on immovable bases, but there are more stirring features still, for the prophet describes the visible expansion of this power before the eyes of the beholder. It grows up like a silent seed in a quiet field, and far outside the turmoil and strife of aggressive conflict, expands into empire.
Prophecy notes this point, and history, describing it, unconsciously in the very language of the prediction, responds thereto. It has multiplied its territory till it has outstripped all other nations in rapidity of territorial growth. In population, it has grown from 3 to 70 million in a little more than 100 years. It largely supplies the world with cereals, cotton, gold and silver, coal, oil, machinery, and the bones and sinews of industrial life and commerce, till its exports now overrun the $1 billion mark. It has revolutionized domestic commercial intercourse by its advancements in the arts, sciences, inventions, lighting, locomotion by sea and land, discoveries and improvements of all kinds. Gold has multiplied till we are the richest nation on the globe. We have alarmed Europe by our invasion of its industries and have become the leading commercial nation of the world. Can anyone intelligently answer the question, what do these things mean? Except on the ground that America is a subject of prophecy and is rapidly filling out the prophetic outline which has been prescribed for her? The full appreciation of this fact should not fail to be realized. But do you say that while this part of the picture is so abundantly fulfilled, there are other features which cannot appear? For the prophet declares that this symbolic beast spake as a dragon, and that speaking as a dragon cannot mean anything less than exercising a dragonic spirit and manifesting persecution, oppression, and wrong, and that it cannot be that in this land of liberty and liberality such things can occur?
But remember that a symbol cannot fulfill the very specifications ascribed to it without being the power concerning which the prophecy has spoken. And hence, the voice of God is behind its acts, not necessarily in approval, but in declaration of the facts. The United States is the power in question, and prophecy is not deceived nor misled by its profession. While it looked so innocent and mild, the prophet heard it speak, and the voice was that of a dragon. Would not any move in this direction, in a course so improbable, unnatural, and unreasonable, clinch the application and demonstrate unmistakably that the correct view of what is to come is presented, "He spake as a dragon"? Testimony has been given, showing how, like a peal of thunder from a clear sky, a sentiment has sprung up, as mysterious and uncalled for as the birth of sin itself, that civil law must come to the rescue of religion, and the power of God give place to human legislation in His work. An idea suddenly seized bigoted and prejudiced minds that a supposed institution of the law of God, a pseudo-Sabbath, must be propped up by decisions of courts and forced upon the people, against their will, by fines and imprisonments. Can it not be seen that that would be a death blow to freedom of conscience, the destruction of religious liberty, the turning back to all the darkness, cruelty, and oppression of the Dark Ages, and the opening of the door to the fulfillment of the most startling and repulsive features of the prophecy? Can anyone longer doubt the coming accomplishment of the evil movements foretold? Consider further that these sentiments are not the spasmodic ebullition of the cranky ideas of a single individual, but they have taken possession of multitudes of men who have banded together into an association taking the name of the National Reform Association, devoted to the idea of making such changes in the national constitution as will secure the ends proposed. Is not this marvelous? Can it be accounted for only on the ground that we have reached the time predicted when darkness covers the earth and gross darkness the people, and that this prophecy is about to be accomplished? But it may be objected further that such a change cannot take place in this country without overturning the foundations of our government and repudiating the principles upon which it is established. Very true. And stranger still to say, the way is even now being prepared for just such changes in the government to take place. First, the Declaration of Independence, that glorious aegis of human liberty, is discarded. Its everlasting truth, that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, is denounced as the old Philadelphia lie by these national reformers.
They would have it that governments derive all their powers directly from God, said powers to be interpreted and applied by His agents, alias themselves. Secondly, the Constitution of the United States, a document which has been described by a leading organ of opinion in England as the most sacred political document in the world, has been repudiated. It has been denied the privilege of following the flag. The United States has shown itself willing to extend its jurisdiction over subject peoples, while at the same time denying to them the assurances of civil and religious rights which the Constitution guarantees. This is national apostasy. And this is today taking place right before our eyes. It ought to make the nerves of every intelligent man tremble with apprehension as he contemplates the inevitable results of such a course. Ancient prophecy foretold it. Modern prophecy applies and repeats it and says, "When Protestantism shall stretch her hand across the gulf to grasp the hand of the Roman power, when she shall reach over the abyss to clasp hands with spiritualism, when, under the influence of this threefold union, our country shall repudiate every principle of its constitution as a Protestant and Republican government, and shall make provision for the propagation of papal falsehoods and delusions, then we may know that the time has come for the marvelous working of Satan, and that the end is near." As the approach of the Roman armies was a sign to the disciples of the impending destruction of Jerusalem, so may this apostasy be a sign to us that the limit of God's forbearance is reached, and the measure of our nation's iniquity is full, and that the angel of mercy is about to take her flight, never to return. Testimony for the Church, number 32, page 207. Before this was penned, it had been published in a book called The Great Controversy that such a work would be done, the Protestant churches being the leading spirits in it. The reader can judge how fast the prediction is being fulfilled. Steps have been taken and sentiments expressed at which all people, only a generation or two back, would have stood aghast. The Declaration of Independence has been defamed and discarded. The Constitution of the United States, that most sacred political document among men, has been repudiated and ignored. The defection is coming. The apostasy is on. Can anyone longer doubt that all the wicked things the prophecy reveals will surely follow? The lingering thought may remain, reluctant to leave, that men cannot give way to such folly, and it will not come out so bad after all. Listen to another installment of Facts. The National Reform Association, as already noticed, led out in the move to bring about a state of things which would be the nightmare of a strange specter in this country, the virtual union of church and state. Was it not sufficiently startling that right at the time when prophecy called for it, such a movement should burst forth, not simply from one man, but from enough to form an association, some of them men of standing, whose influence was a power for evil? Strange in its beginning, its growth is still stranger. By its growth, we mean the accession of other bodies which have united with it and become its allies. 1. The first of these was the Woman's Christian Temperance Union. The action which committed this organization to this movement was taken in 1885. 2. In 1888, at a convention of Methodist clergymen, the American Sabbath Union was formed in New York City, and it became a notable ally of the National Reform Association. This Sabbath Union organization soon embraced the Presbyterian Church, North and South, the Baptist Union, the United Presbyterian Church, the Congregational Church, the Methodist Protestant Church, and a dozen other religious bodies. In 1892, it boasted that it had secured Sunday legislation from the legislatures of six states. 3. The third combination that became an ally of the National Reform Association was the papacy. It came up in this way. The National Reform Association, at its national convention in 1884, made overtures to the Catholic Church, saying that the time had come to make repeated advances, and that they would gladly accept cooperation in any form in which they, the Catholics, might be willing to grant it.
Christian Statesman, December 11, 1884. In 1888, Cardinal Gibbons endorsed by letter the national reform effort to secure religious legislation from Congress through the Blair Sunday Rest Bill. And in 1889, the Catholic Lay Congress, held in Baltimore, made this declaration, which constitutes a direct reply to the national reform overtures. There are many issues on which Catholics could come together with non-Catholics and shape civil legislation for the public weal. In spite of rebuff and injustice and overlooking zealotry, we would seek an alliance with non-Catholics for proper Sunday observance. Chicago Inter-Ocean, November 13, 1889. 4. In 1891, there was organized the Massachusetts Sabbath Association, which a few years later had developed into the New England Sabbath Protective League, an active association publishing a monthly organ, The Defender, supported by Senator Hoar and other influential men of New England. 5. In the same year, 1891, the Great Christian Endeavor Society, in its convention at Minneapolis, practically endorsed the national reform movement and has ever since been active in supporting Sunday legislation. 6. Out of the Christian Endeavor movement grew, in 1896, Christian citizenship, which has been an active ally of the national reform movement ever since.
7. In addition to all these, there have been formed during the closing years of the century the New York Sabbath Committee, the League for Social Service, led by Dr. Josiah Strong, the Woman's National Sabbath Sunday Alliance, the Sunday League of America, and the Reform Bureau at Washington, D.C., presided over by Dr. W.F. Crafts. All these organizations stand together, and as we have seen, Protestants stand with Catholics in support of legislation for the observance of Sunday. The New York Sabbath Committee, organized in 1857, is the pioneer in soliciting the cooperation of Rome in enforcing Sunday observance. The secretary, W.W. Atterbury, D.D., says, "It aims to combine the efforts of all good citizens, Protestants, Roman Catholics, and others, in protection of the day, etc." 8. Religious measures pressed upon Congress. Following the attempt to make Congress commit itself to Sunday legislation in the matter of Sunday mails in 1829-30, a long period intervened before another religious measure sought the endorsement of the national legislature. The rise of the National Reform Association in 1863 was the event which led to the next attempt of this kind, and indeed, to every attempt of this nature that has since been made. In 1874, this association felt itself strong enough to address the government directly, and accordingly petitioned Congress to so amend the Constitution as to put into that instrument a recognition of God as the nation's ruler and make His revealed will the supreme law in civil affairs. This petition was referred to a committee, and that committee reported that the framers of the Constitution had purposely omitted such recognition, and that such a change in the fundamental law would be an uncalled for and dangerous innovation. The petition consequently failed, and the reformers, having thus felt the pulse of Congress, temporarily retired from the field of legislation, not to abandon their purpose, but only to wait for a more favorable opportunity.
9. By the year 1888, the reformers were reinforced by the Woman's Christian Temperance Union and the National Prohibition Party, the WCTU, leading. Attack was again made on Congress by a petition to suppress Sunday trains, Sunday mails, and Sunday military duties. In May of the same year, a Sunday rest bill was introduced into the Senate by Senator Blair of New Hampshire, forbidding labor on Sunday in the District of Columbia. Almost simultaneously with this, and from the same source, came a joint resolution calling for an amendment to the Constitution, which would require each state to teach in the public schools the principles of the Christian religion. Every pressure possible was brought to bear upon Congress in favor of these bills, especially the Sunday Rest Bill. One of the tricks resorted to was this. Cardinal Gibbons endorsed the bill, and on the strength of his endorsement, all the Catholics of the country, 14 million, were at once counted as supporters of the bill.
The fraud did not work, and the bills were lost. 10. In January 1890, the Reform Combination came forward again with a Sunday rest bill, but it was toned down to be much less comprehensive than the Blair bill. It was promoted by Congressman W.C.P. Breckinridge of Kentucky and afterward by Congressman Morse of Massachusetts, but it failed to be enacted into law. Still, the attack upon Congress was kept up, with an occasional omen of success till the time of the Columbian Exposition.
The question then became a burning one, whether the fair should be kept open on Sunday or not. A Columbian Sunday Association had been organized in 1891 expressly to work for the Sunday closing of the fair. The Columbian Commission were not in favor of an open fair. But what the church wished especially to obtain was a recognition of Sunday by act of the national legislature. It was accomplished in this way. Congress was expected to appropriate $2,500,000 in aid of the fair, and this gift might be made conditional on the Sunday closing. Hence, to this end, the Sunday closers bent all their energies. They found champions in Senator Hawley of Connecticut and Senator Quay of Pennsylvania. The latter, in his argument, had occasion to call for the reading in the Senate of the Fourth Commandment, spoken by the Creator on Mount Sinai. The Sunday closing proviso had already passed the House, and under the lead of Senators Hawley and Quay, it secured the concurrence of the Senate. Soon afterward, the bill received the signature of President Harrison, and thus became a national law. Thus, Congress had at last capitulated. The national legislature had distinctly committed itself to the cause of Sunday observance. It had decreed that the Columbian Exposition be closed on Sunday, and thus be made to observe what is called the Christian Sabbath. By causing the Fourth Commandment to be read and applying it to Sunday, it had declared the Christian Sabbath to be the first day of the week, commonly called Sunday. This was the congressional interpretation of what Jehovah meant in reference to the Sabbath when he declared, "The seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God." Here was a precedent and a foundation for any future legislation by Congress which the National Reform Alliance might demand. It was a great victory for Sunday enforcement, and the promoters of that cause were wild with joy.
Another device resorted to by them to secure this evil victory is worthy of notice. It was the threatening to boycott every politician who opposed the measure. It is well known that if there is any point on which the average politician is abnormally weak and supersensitive, it is the point of losing his office, to save which he will crawl abjectly in the dust before any voter. So effective was this device that some politicians were overheard counseling among themselves to this effect. "You know," said one, "that we want to come back to Congress." "But how shall we get here," said another, "except by yielding to the clergy?" By this, the clergy learned that they had power to intimidate Congress sufficiently to carry their measures through that body by threats. It was the boast of one clergyman soon afterward, "I have learned that we hold the United States Senate in our hands." Dr. H. H. George, speech in Paterson, New Jersey. Following this lead, bills have been brought before Congress as follows. 1. Calling for a national university in which Christian theology shall be taught. 2. Bills to increase chaplains in the army. 3. A bill asking Congress to forbid the opening on Sunday of any exhibition receiving money from the government. 4. Sunday rest bills in both the Senate and the House. 11. In 1891, the National Reformers came again before Congress with the Religious Amendment Scheme, which reached its climax in a hearing before the House Committee on the Judiciary. The committee being unanimously opposed to the bill, it failed to pass. But in the hearts of the promoters, their original purpose still lives, and they are patiently biding their time. 1. The facts stated in the preceding 11 paragraphs are gathered principally from the tract Religious Liberty in the 19th Century.
While these movements were on foot in legislative and judicial channels, there was no lack of activity in the field of the practical application of these principles, as shown in the inevitable result of oppression and persecution. The blows were aimed at the observers of the seventh day, as shown on a preceding page, while others who more flagrantly violated the first day, if they did not pay respect to the seventh day, were with hypocrisy and discrimination passed by in silence.
In 1885, the exemption clause of the Sunday law in Arkansas was repealed. The movement to overthrow Seventh-day observance began with this in earnest. There had been previously a few arrests of Sabbath keepers for so-called violations of the Sunday law, 3 in Michigan, 1 in Georgia, 2 in California. In 1882, the California Sunday law was repealed and to this day has not been reenacted. Prosecutions commenced in both Arkansas and Tennessee in 1885. 6 arrests were made in Arkansas, 3 in Tennessee. Refusing to pay fines, the victims were thrown into jail. In some cases, seizure and sale of goods was made to pay fines and costs. And in several instances, the victims have fallen in death, their death being plainly attributable to the hardship and exposure of their prosecution and imprisonment. They have thus fallen in this boasted land of enlightenment, and in this vaunted age of religious liberty, as veritable martyrs to their convictions of truth and duty as any that have gone down in death at the stake or in the dungeons of the Romish Inquisition. In view of these things, dare anyone look up unblushingly to heaven and say that there is nothing to these movements and that our application of the prophecy is wrong? 12. In politics. Not only has the religious amendment spirit permeated the great religious bodies, as noticed, but it has risen to that degree of strength that it has thought to control political bodies of a national character and swing them around into its own channel. Or rather, the religious bodies have conceived the idea that they could draw to themselves the strength of political organizations to help forward their own ends. The Christian Endeavor movement has formed what is called the Christian Citizenship League, designed to combine the strength of all the churches in this movement. W. H. McMillan, addressing a convention of this league a few years ago in Boston, said,
"Here is a power that is going to wrest the control of affairs from the hands of political demagogues and place it in the hands of Him who is King over all and rules the world in righteousness. Our political leaders have been counting the saloon vote, the illiterate vote, and the stay-at-home vote, and all other elements that have hitherto entered into their canvassing of probabilities, but they have not yet learned to count the Christian Endeavor vote. I want to serve notice on them now that the time is drawing near when they will discover that a political revolution has occurred, and they will be found coming home from Washington and our state capitals without a job." These sentiments were cheered to the echo. If anything will drive politicians into the church, such sentiments will. And now it seems that a new party has arisen, or an old party under perhaps a new name, called the United Christian Party. And what do they propose to do? A brief extract from the opening of their platform will explain.
"We, the United Christian Party, in National Convention in the city of Rock Island, Illinois, May 1st and 2nd, 1900, acknowledging Almighty God as the source of all power and authority, the Lord Jesus Christ as the sovereign ruler of nations, and the Bible as the standard by which to decide moral issues in our political life, do make the following declaration. We believe the time to have arrived when the eternal principles of justice, mercy, and love, as exemplified in the life and teachings of Jesus Christ, should be embodied in the Constitution of our nation and applied in concrete form to every function of our government. We maintain that this statement is in harmony with the fundamental principles of our national common law, our Christian usages and customs, of the Declaration of the Supreme Court of the United States that this is a Christian nation, and the accepted principle in judicial decisions that no law should contravene the divine law. Desecration of the Sabbath. We deprecate certain immoral laws which have grown out of the failure of our nation to recognize these principles,
notably such as require the desecration of the Christian Sabbath, authorize unscriptural marriage and divorce, and license the manufacture and sale of intoxicating liquors as a beverage. Immoral laws. The execution of these immoral laws above mentioned, we hold to be neither loyalty to our country nor honoring to God. Therefore, it shall be our purpose to administer the government, so far as it shall be entrusted to us by the suffrages of the people, in accordance with the principles herein set forth. And until amended, our oath of office shall be to the Constitution and laws as herein explained, and to no other. And we will look to Him who has all power in heaven and in earth to vindicate our purpose in seeking His glory and the welfare of our beloved land. These words are well adapted to appeal to the religious sentiment of the people, and one might almost think that they were written by a national reformer himself. The fly in the ointment is the express desire and intention to place religious customs and usages on a legal basis, which means to enforce them upon the people and put the conscience under constraint. This would introduce the deadly virus into our government, which would work the destruction of its life and be the fatal blow to both civil and religious liberty.
Premonitory workings of this course of action have already appeared, showing its nature and results too plainly to be mistaken. 90 arrests of Seventh-day keepers have been made, some of them under circumstances of great cruelty and oppression. The prisoners have served an aggregate of nearly 1,500 days in jail and in chain gangs. Two men have lost their lives through the hardships to which they have been subjected. Secular papers have quite generally spoken out in loud protest and condemnation against the monstrous hypocrisy, injustice, and wrong of these things. But what about the religious press, whose professed principles would compel them to protest? With a few honorable exceptions, religionists have treated the matter with utter indifference and silence, especially those who have taken the pains to sneer at our apprehension that great evil was sure to result from this tampering with the laws. They have averred with a cynical smile that the movement would not harm a hair of our head. But when the religious machine begins to grind, they have not a whisper of apology, or a word of censure, or a note of protest to offer. It is not for the hair of our head that we are specially solicitous, but we raise a warning against national apostasy, which means national ruin.
But if prophecy outlines this work, it may be said, you cannot stop it. Very true. Isolated individuals cannot turn back the tide and save the nation. But individuals can save themselves. A prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself. Proverbs 27, verse 12. To save as many as possible from a catastrophe which is to swallow up so many should be the object of every lover of truth. With a true evangelical spirit, we seek not yours, but you. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 14. The third message of Revelation 14, verse 9-12, is a special message with respect to this very crisis. If any man worship the beast and his image, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God. The cup into which this wine is poured is composed of his indignation, and the condition in which it is poured is without mixture, without any mixture of mercy or hope. This is the storm center around which, with cyclonic speed and power, the closing scenes of these last days now revolve. But on the brow of this dark and troublous cloud glows the bright bow of divine promise. There shall be a time of trouble such as never was, and at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. Daniel 12, verse 1. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked. Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation, there shall no evil befall thee,
neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. Psalm 91, verse 1, 4, 8, 10. With this presentation of the argument, we here rest the case, feeling that no further statement is called for. We have not sought for any novel, sensational, or overdrawn arguments, but have endeavored only to present a plain array of scriptural and self-evident truths and a platform of firm, immovable facts that will stand the test of the great day when every refuge of lies will be swept away and every covenant with death be disannulled. Isaiah 28, verse 16, 18. Finis.